This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 4th of December, 2012, on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. In celebration of Monocle's latest outpost opening, a beautiful new HQ, shop and radio studio in the bustling heart of Toronto's Little Italy neighbourhood, this week's Section D is devoted to Canadian design. Canada is not a nation renowned for its design, but as we'll discover over the next hour, there's a plethora of plucky people, places, and institutions keen to change our opinion. Coming up, we take a tour of Toronto's retail emporium, Avenue Road, and quiz its owner, Stefan Weishaupt, on the local scene.
We have quite a reach of furniture pieces from mid-century Brazilian to contemporary European to Japanese to Middle Eastern contemporary furniture designs.
We head to Vancouver to uncover the charming city's young crowd of gifted makers.
Vancouver is an immigrant city. Most of us come from somewhere else. So with that, we brought with us a very different cultural expectation than, say, the typical North American city like LA or Detroit or whatever.
And back in Toronto, we visit the Canadian Textile Museum to talk traditional craft and the importance of preservation.
The great thing about textiles is that it's a medium that is common throughout the globe, throughout history.
Plus, we'll talk retail and furniture with Sean Moore and Julie Nicholson from Toronto store Made. We'll hit the folk at Garrison's Barbers to hear how Torontonians like to keep their facial hair. And we'll hear from Toronto's celebrity designers, George Yabu and Glenn Puschelberg, who'll divulge their thoughts on the future of Canadian design too. And it wouldn't be a Canadian show without a tune or two from the country's legendary popstrels either. That's all to come in the next hour here on our special Canada edition of Section D. We start this Canadian design special talking textiles. Much like a time capsule, textiles can be a narrative history, leaving subtle clues to tradition within their weaves. In the heart of Toronto, the Textile Museum of Canada has a rich collection of traditional fabrics, garments, carpets, and artefacts, such as beadwork and basketry, that each reflects inherited traditions. Section D's producer, Gillian Tobias, met with the curator-in-residence, Kari Liao, and started by asking her to explain the raison d'être for the museum.
Well, the Textile Museum of Canada has a number of different mandates and goals. I would have to say the number one reason would probably be to represent Canada and the diversity here of its people, as well as kind of act as a platform for international audiences to come see what we produce, as well as bring like a global perspective to Canada as well, to share that. The great thing about textiles is that it's a medium that is common throughout the globe, throughout history, you know, anywhere from the clothes that you wear to your mother's draperies to, you know, the 50-foot long carpet that lines palaces in the Middle East. In regards to your question about how textiles can represent a nation, I would say that it's through just the connection, the immediate relationship with how we use them in everyday life and see them in everyday life. For some reason, textiles have been able to kind of capture this, and maybe that's because it's a soft fabric and it's something that's malleable. I guess a really good example of how textiles can kind of narrate a story would be through the quilt, the everyday quilt, you know. The quilt is a textile that is supposed to represent a history, a past that you're supposed to pass on to, you know, your children and your later generation. So it's almost a time capsule of culture and your own history, as well as a collective one. Yeah. The quilt is probably the number one textile that has been passed on, specifically the Hudson Bay Point blankets. It would definitely come up in a lot of conversations about Canadian textiles. That has a kind of troubled history, actually, with our First Nations people here. It's controversial, and there are no real ways to kind of substantiate the facts, but it's been said that the Hudson Bay Point blankets carried smallpox, and because of that, it was kind of a government conspiracy to kind of wipe out the First Nations people through genocide. And it seems like a wild claim, yet at the same time, you know, you kind of wonder, was this object, this cultural object, really capable of such a travesty? And so, yeah, it's definitely something that is debated upon today. So the blanket, you know, an everyday object that everybody has in their house, is also seen as this terrifying potential, you know, bed of disease. So that it would probably be one particular piece that I can think that represents, in a strange way, our Canadian identity, definitely our history. In Canada, there's so many diverse people here that it's hard to really pinpoint one type of fabric or textiles or technique that is truly Canadian. But if we're speaking on a historical basis, then rug hooking, weaving, embroidery, that's all within the language of Canadian aesthetic and textile traditions. We actually just had a show called Dreamland that just closed, unfortunately, but it displayed textiles from, you know, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th century that were at the forefront of design. Things that you would see in IKEA today or Pier 1 Import was made by hand by, you know, women in their houses, by families, and not machines. So unique creativity and innovation that existed prior to these big box design stores.
That was our producer, Gillian Tobias, with the curator in residence of the Canadian Textile Museum, Carrie Liao. If you've just joined us, you're listening to a Canadian Design special edition of Section D. Still to come, we'll uncover the delights of Vancouver's local design scene and talk facial hair with Toronto barbers, Garrisons. But for the time being, we're sticking around in Toronto a little longer to visit a retail hotspot that's promoting the Made in Canada brand. Nestled on Toronto's Dundas Street West, MADE is a venture that has been discovering Canadian product designers and selling their creations to Torontonians and visitors to the city for 6 years now. Co-owners Sean Moore and Julie Nicholson showed our associate editor, Nelly Gocheva, around their shop and shared their views on the local scene.
We represent exclusively Canadian design. A lot of what we do is custom work. And the people that we represent are all operating on a very small scale, produce in either a small studio setting where they're self-producing, or else they're coordinating the production of work and doing final assembly or packaging themselves. We represent between 60 and 70 different independent designers from coast to coast in Canada, but probably about 80% of them are from Toronto and the area around Toronto. We have people like The Brothers Dressler, Loyal Lute Collective, Catherine Walter of Felt Studio, Catherine Morley, who's a local industrial designer.
How do you select the designers that you present? How do you find them?
There's a lot of different avenues. Some of it is to do with research and paying attention to what's currently happening. And often there's recommendations from designers we're already working with, and they tell us about somebody else they know. And so we always like to delve in whatever direction we've found something from. We like to delve in a little bit and find out more about them and what they're up to. And then we'll arrange to meet if it seems like it's following our sort of aesthetic and trajectory, and that it's something that would have a conversation with the other objects in the store.
What about your typical customer? Do you think that the consumer here in Canada is really educated design-wise, and they know what they're after?
I think if we're talking specifically about our customer, I think they very often are educated and they're already quite passionate about design in general. So they have a sort of, they're already forearmed with a lot of knowledge, but they're really keen to know a lot more as well. So they may not know specifics about particular designers, but they do appreciate the techniques and the ideas that are coming through. So they're willing to follow that up and find out even more.
What is your take on Canadian manufacturing?
That's actually another stumbling block, I think, for a lot of people getting further along with their work, is that a lot of manufacturing has disappeared here. So ceramics, everything that we carry is self-manufactured because there is zero ceramic industry in Canada. There's a couple of places that produce hotel china, that type of thing, but there is nowhere that will work with a small-scale designer to do production porcelain, for instance. There is no more glass production in Canada, so it's really only art glass, like people that are doing their own glass blowing that can produce glassware here. There's a bit of scientific glass production in Canada, but they won't work with small studios either. And then furniture-wise tends to be the one that people are able to do more of, because there is reasonable size furniture production in Canada, and even the smaller studios that are producing their own work are able to do it at a certain scale and are able to bring in more staff if they get busier. But I think it's the little things that especially suffer because there isn't enough manufacturing here.
And one last question, what is Nexpo Made? Are you guys planning anything new, exciting?
Well, we're currently working towards Design Week in January in Toronto. We are part of the organisers for an event called Do Design, which is in along Dundas West, actually, and placing objects of design into different storefronts and venues along the street. So it's a very sort of community engaged project where people can trip from one building to another and investigate what's out there that's current and contemporary. So that's always exciting, and we'll work on some curatorial projects for next year and continue to build on what we do here, which is custom building and creating products that people really desire.
That was Nelly Gochiva there with Sean Moore and Julie Nicholson, co-owners of the Toronto store Made. Coming up, we'll drop in on Avenue Road, another larger Canadian design institution that's just opened across the border in New York. But first, a short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Ambitious architects, best-in-show builders, concrete connoisseurs, density designers, energy evangelists, friendly foxes, guerrilla gardeners, high-minded historians, inspirational investors, jaded janitors, Kmart killjoys, low-rise lovers, mighty mayors, naughty nocturnalists, office block occupiers, plotting planners, quietness questers, rebels and reactionaries, spick and span street sweepers, transport theorists, urbane urbanists, visiting visionaries, wily wayfinders, exemplary exiles, you and yours, and zero emission zealots. For full A to Z of the people who make our metropolises rattle along like a well-designed subway and occasionally screech to halt like one too, listen to The Urbanist, the show about the cities we live in, presented by me, Andrew Tuck. It premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. That's The Urbanist, the show for people who know that the countryside is for softies and that it doesn't matter if you can't find two words beginning with X.
Welcome back to a special Canadian design edition of Section D. Spread over three floors on Toronto's East Avenue and with a brand new showroom in New York, Avenue Road has been slowly but surely cementing its name on the North American interior design scene. It offers a hand-picked collection of exclusive collaborations with Canadian and international designers, including Christophe Delcour, Simone Kost, Yabu Puschelberg, Anna Torfs and Lutz Konek, to name just a few. Monocle's associate editor, Nelly Gochiva, chatted with owner Stefan Weishaupt about Avenue Road's recent collaborations, the best local and international brands to invest in at the moment, and the current tastes and habits of the Canadian consumer.
Well, we started the business about five years ago. Initially, the idea was to have a concept space for furniture pieces, primarily contemporary and mid-century furniture pieces. We wanted to showcase them here in Canada and get market feedback and see what Avenue Road would be in the mid and long term. And now Avenue Road has in Toronto a fairly large showroom. We have a reach of furniture pieces from mid-century Brazilian to contemporary European to Japanese to Middle Eastern contemporary furniture designs. In New York, we opened up a studio in May of 2012, and we're focusing there on our designers that we represent exclusively in North America. So we have Christoph Delcour, Jabo Puschelberg, Anna Torfs, and other designers that we represent there.
How do you select your brands, the brands and the designers that you collaborate with?
I look for stories. I look for pieces that have history, that have an interesting angle, a different point of view, something that sets them apart beyond just the design aspect. I look for very strong relationships with the designers that I represent. So we work very often together in making the product right for our marketplace. I'm looking for something that is truly unique, that really stands out in a sense of design, material usage, and so forth.
You have brands and designers from all over the world. Can you name some of them?
Christoph Delcour is one of the biggest ones, most important ones. He's based in Paris, and we've been working together for 5 years now. It's been a fantastic journey together. We've developed a lot of things together for North America, so that's really great. Another one is Jabo Puschelberg, a Toronto-based design firm. I've been personal friends with them for a long time, and we've developed some interesting furniture pieces, and we're going to add to the collection next year, which I'm really excited about. Other designers include Marcel Wolterink, for example, from the Netherlands. He's made a beautiful furniture collection for one of our Dutch suppliers that I represent also here exclusively in New York and Toronto.
What about Canadian designers? Because you're here in Toronto, you're German then in Toronto also. Yeah. So what is your take on Canadian design, and how do you work with Canadian brands? How do you select them?
There's no real Canadian brands really that represent, so we decided to do it on our own and go on our own. I started off with a very interesting piece called The Court Chair by a French Quebec designer, Jacques Guillon. And he designed this piece in the early 60s. It's a lovely chair, and you can see it in a lot of books today and in a lot of museums, MoMA and other museums. And it hasn't been in production for a long time, and we decided a few years back to reissue it. My focus was really to get it also Canadian made. It was one of the true Canadian mid-century designs, and it was very important to me that it would still be made in Canada today. We had to make some minor changes to it to make sure it's stable and meets today's requirements, but it's overall it's very unique to its original and true to its original, and it's a beautiful piece, and that's where we started off. Then we collaborated with some other designers such as Moss and Lamb. Deborah Moss and Edward Lamb have also been friends with me for a long time, and they've done a lot of larger projects. They're very good in surfaces, material selections. They're very graphic. So we designed a few pieces, very quirky, whimsical pieces that I'm very proud of, that we have them now in our collection, and they've been very successful and the market likes them. And then last but not least, obviously my relationship with Jabo Puschelberg also resulted in some interesting furniture pieces, very Jabo Puschelberg style. I mean, they've been very successful in, you know, representing a Canadian design firm, active globally, all over the world, with some top brands and hospitality, retail. So over the years, we've developed a nice little collection as well, and we produced them very successfully in Canada.
And business-wise, what do you expect from New York? Why did you open a venue there?
We always had a lot of customers in New York. a lot of design firms that we work with, and New York is, from obviously for several reasons, a very important destination, location for us to be in. Maybe media, maybe design firms, clients. New York also gets a lot of, unlike Toronto, they get a lot of international travelers that shop there. Toronto is more a local community here. It's local. It's about local customers, local opportunities. New York is way more international. We're working on another location. I can't quite disclose yet where that's going to be, but it will definitely be next year, and I'm really excited about it already.
Are you looking elsewhere in Canada, or are we talking about abroad, Europe?
I see Avenue Road really as a North American furniture company. Mm-hmm. I find that Europe and Asia and South America, the markets work very differently. So our business model cannot necessarily be applied to other markets like that, not just yet. So, and I think there's a lot more opportunity here in North America right now that we can still tap into and explore. So yeah, my goal in the short and midterm is to further explore opportunities here in North America. And that's both Canada and the United States.
That was Stefan Weishaupt, owner of Avenue Road, with our associate editor Nelly Gochiva there in Toronto. If you've just joined us, you're listening to a Canadian Design special edition of Section D in celebration of Monocle's recent HQ opening in Toronto. Still to come, Nelly will be talking facial hair trends with Garrison Barbers. But before that, we're off to the West Coast, to Vancouver. There's long been a good-humoured rivalry between Toronto and Vancouver, with the smaller West Coast city often mocked as a bit of a lotus land. With a temperate climate and a natural playground to do the proverbial ski, golf and sail all on the same day, Vancouverites definitely revel in a more laid-back lifestyle than their East Coast cousins. That doesn't mean, however, they're a slouch in the design department. From notable architecture to furniture and shoes, Lucy Hislop caught up with three busy makers, helping to reinvent Vancouver's reputation as a city where design thrives.
Above the din of traffic rumbling over cobblestones, the Gastown steam clock is in fine fettle today. Ancient-looking and ornate, it toots every 15 minutes in the heart of Gastown, just outside Vancouver's downtown core. For a city that's only existed for 125 years, there's a decent whiff of history here. With lamplights and low-rise turn-of-the-century brick buildings, the area has long been a magnet for tourists. But in recent years, the neighbourhood has been rescued from offering just souvenir stores to become the vanguard for creatives. The renaissance is partly due to Gastown having lower rents than in downtown. The area does sit, after all, next to the downtown east side, ground zero for most of the city's homeless, and one of the poorest postcodes in North America. Over a flat white in Nelson the Seagull Cafe, shoe designer John Fluvog explains why he set up the headquarters of his eponymous company here.
I've always been in up-and-coming areas. All my shops, I have shops in other cities. Generally speaking, they're in somewhat obscure up-and-coming areas. I tend to pick them that way because I'm familiar with them. And I like the idea of being a little on the edge. So it suits me. I ended up living down here. And I bought this pretty crazy cool apartment. I got this awesome view of the mountains and the ocean and the back of the city. I got this crazy cool view. But it's in this grungy area. Maybe I get rid of some of my guilt conscience of having this cool apartment, that I can have it in this place, or something kind of edgy about it. But I like picking areas that are real and genuine, and I think, you know, quote, hipsters kind of gravitate to those kind of places.
The fact that Fluvog, like others, can now live here is another major reason for Gastown's reinvention. In the past, the neighborhood wasn't zoned for residential. And while that meant that a slice of Vancouver's heritage was saved, it turned into a ghost town at night when the shops shut. One of the most heralded recent developments is the Woodwards Tower. Combining condos, social housing, a grocery store, university campus, and indoor basketball court, it was designed to create a kind of instant community hub. The mixed-use design is part of a city-wide movement known as Vancouverism, founded in part by veteran architect James Chang. I'm heading up to his concrete and glass office just south of Gastown and greeted by a peachy view of the city. Ocean, mountains lightly dusted with snow, and a skyline dominated by glistening modern towers. With Cheng designing 50 of them, including the Shangri-La, Vancouver's tallest building, it's pretty much like looking at his portfolio. Born in Hong Kong, Cheng first worked in California before moving, in the early 70s, to Vancouver. He felt that the relatively undeveloped frontier city offered him a better chance to strike out on his own as an architect, and believes his style of designing can be traced back to those early days in a residential neighborhood downtown.
Well, part of it is a reaction. When I first moved up from San Francisco, I rented in a high-rise in the West End. And for 3 years, I did not make a single friend in my building. Okay? And I thought something's wrong with that kind of living. And in those days, if you live in an apartment in the West End, means you can't afford a house. So it was a social stigma as well. But the way they were designed, there's no way for you to meet people.
Social interaction and life in between buildings became priorities, as well as using glass, not only to allow in views of the mountains and oceans, but also to keep condos lighter in dank winters. Initially modelled on Paris, the landlocked city was now swapping eight-storey buildings for massive high-rises and mandating view corridors that prevented developments from obstructing views of certain natural landmarks. For Cheng, Vancouver is simply not your average North American city.
Vancouver is an immigrant city. Most of us come from somewhere else. So with that, we brought with us a very different cultural expectation than, say, the typical North American city like LA or Detroit or whatever, where the car is everything. When we have people from old Europe, they're used to living in close quarters. When we have people from Asia, we're used to living in densities. So as a result of that, we don't always want the American dream, you know, a single family house on acres of empty land just go on for eons. We understand that we need the social contact. We, as a city, love to eat, we love to walk, we love to hang out by the beach. So, you know, as a result of that, we don't like urban sprawl. We have the West End that has one of the highest density long before we talk about eco-density. So we always have a downtown population. I think that's probably the most important ingredient to separate us from elsewhere.
It's no stretch to say Fluvog feels this sense of separateness, and the city's physical remoteness thousands of miles from other major Canadian ones has worked well for his quirky designs over the past four decades. Back at his Gastown store and office, full of shoe lasts and his latest designs, he explains how he soon learned not to follow the crowd.
Well, you get a sense, I think, when you're cut off, is I don't need to fit in. And that's, I think, a big jump when us as designers can actually be bold enough to say, hey, I don't need to fit in, and have the courage to go and do it, and to be separate and be apart. And I think that those are the things that, if done correctly and done well, are the things that people will gravitate to.
As a testament to the level of interest in design generally in Vancouver, I'm mingling with some of the 15,000 residents who ping like human pinballs around 400 studios open as part of the three-day Eastside Culture Crawl. At 1000 Parker Street, a cavernous 1920s warehouse on industrial land just east of Gastown, I pop in to see furniture maker Christian Wu and catch him smiling at the fact visitors are running their hands all over his minimalist walnut beds, tables and cupboards.
That is a huge buzz, and it feels really nice to have people pat you on your back. You spend the other 360 some odd days a year in the studio with the door shut, questioning yourself all the time. And it's really nice. For a few days, you have people come in and either love what you do or not love what you do. But that's okay. I mean, not everybody is going to like what you do. But I think there's no denying that people appreciate that we are there doing what we're doing.
The former set carpenter in the film industry, whose new furniture line has orders from Abu Dhabi and New York, describes what Vancouver means to his work.
I've often thought of it internally as a balancing out. You know, our environment here being quite rugged, I've tried to offset that in my own little way with cleaner lined pieces. I don't tire of working with wood. It's tiring work, it's physical, but it's energizing and it's exciting. And it's an obsession.
Youthful enthusiasm that seems fitting for a city that's one of the youngest in the world. And it reminds me of the line from The City of Glass, Vancouver writer Douglas Copeland's book on his hometown. One day we'll be old and creaky, but not now. Right now is for being young. For Monocle, in Vancouver, I'm Lucy Hislop.
Time now for a quick bit of music from Canada. Here's my favourite current Canadian singer-songwriter of the moment, bar Celine and Avril, of course. This is Grimes with Genesis. If you've just joined us, you're listening to a Canadian Design Special Edition of Section D. We're off to the barbers next to hear about facial hair. But before that, a short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
On Monocle's Culture Show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising, and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed, intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
Welcome back to Section D. Taking a small break from talking furniture in Toronto, Associate Editor Nelly Gochiva stopped by Garrison's Barbershop on thriving Queen Street West to find out about the latest beard trends, the hair care products, and the perfect moustache for the festive season. She chatted with Chief Barber Alan Brown and co-owner Hollis Hopkins.
This actually used to be my home. We bought the building, about maybe 7 years ago. And we love this neighborhood. It's obviously a very artistic neighborhood. A lot of really great things happening here on the creative side of things. But after we started a family, it just didn't make sense to be here anymore. So the idea when we kind of bought the property was to always put in what we call institutionalized businesses. So something that would be here in 20, 30 longer years that wasn't too trendy and it just made sense and the neighborhood loved it and wanted to keep it. So when our tenants, when we moved out and then our tenants moved out, we thought, you know what, let's put a commercial store in here. And my husband, who had been going to various salons in the neighborhood and not really that happy, thought, you know what, we don't have a barbershop in this neighborhood. Why don't we do something like that? I thought he was crazy because neither of us know anything about barbering. We're both kind of in business and consultant, I'm a researcher, but we're like, all right, seems to make sense. And here we are, it's not even quite 2 years and I think we're doing really well. We were lucky to be on this amazing strip on Queen Street West, which has the most male-oriented retailers, I think, in all of North America. We're certainly one of. So we've got a whole lot of people walking down the street who live and work here, who care about their appearance, and so it made perfect sense. The guys that come here, really, we have, you know, like 3-year-old kids to, you know, 72-year-old men, And I think what they have in common is that they feel that they can kind of really just be guys here. And it's not about it being like a manly man. People are like, oh, are you going to have, you know, topless girls and a TV showing sports? We're like, not a chance. We really just want it to be a place where a guy could kind of come, chill out, relax, not edit what they're saying about anything. I used to work upstairs, and the conversations that I heard were, would, you know, curl your hair. But that's the idea. It's like, if guys feel that they can talk like that here, then we've done our job.
The fashion changes so quickly down this area. It's like one minute facial hair will be in, next minute it will be out, and which is great for business because everyone comes in and gets it shaved off. I prefer the trend is more the classic style with the twisting on the end of the actual waxed moustache. Looks very classic to go with the classic hairstyling. I mean, there is a term called beard semba, or manuary, which we're trying to bring in, which is where you just don't do anything, but that's not good for business, right? So I think people are going towards the sort of cleaner, sharper look for the season. If you see the Mad Men styling, if you look at Daniel Craig's hair for the new Bond movie, he's got a very similar version of that, but it's actually not quite so slicked and tight in 50s. It's a little looser, a little more contemporary.
We wanted this place to feel like it belonged to the community, and that community is, I mean, not just the Trinity Bellwoods neighborhood, but Toronto or Ontario. So we were thrilled to source a company called Crown Shaving that does shaving and grooming products, hair, shampoo. That made us feel really terrific that we were able to kind of support someone locally. At the same time, honoring what I think of as, you know, true. I mean, there's barbering everywhere in the world, but when I think of barber shops, I think of the UK. So we bring in black and white because that's just like that quintessential classic product for men's hair. And we bring that directly in from the UK because it's actually fairly difficult to get. Products, so it's oversaturation in salons, but there's actually not a lot of men, specifically men's products. And the nice thing about those are they're both classics, but they've been managed to stay current, which is what we hope to do with the barbershop, right? We're kind of a take on a classic, but just kind of brought into the 21st century. And we also have some American products in here. There's just a couple of ones that we handpick, but ultimately it has to be something that the barbers like to use and that they feel comfortable that works in a number of different types of hair, because we do not have, you know, 20 different products in here. We have just about 5 or 6. So we think that they're just classics and they work on almost every type of hair. And we'd never intended to really be selling a lot of our products. It was mostly meant to be used just by the barbers, but people seem to really like them. And so we actually sell out. It's hard to keep our stuff in stock.
We're in sort of Queen West, so I suppose there are areas in London, such as Kensington in London or anywhere like that, which are very, like, not so hipsterish, but kind of a cross between, because there's a lot of lawyers, solicitors, and like architects and stuff, which is where I get that hairstyle that's similar to the Mad Men, but it's not quite so tight. There, I find they're going to kill me back home if anybody ever reads this. I found that North Americans far easier to get on with. They kind of know what they want more. They're more direct in, I want this style, I want this cut, and they will be precise. They know what they want. It's not you getting someone in the chairs going, I don't know. I just don't know. What can I do for you, sir, today? I don't know. And you get that a lot in the UK, very undecided about what they want with their hair. They might see a picture somewhere and they were like, you know, the guy that's in whatever, and you have to kind of really work at it. So cuts down a little of the time here with the consultation. They know what they want, they see what they like, and yeah, and they come back. So the average time is between 30 to 45 minutes, dependent on it. I spend as much time as it takes to make that customer or client happy with his haircut, within reason, you know, if I can. If it took an hour, then I would know that client for next time is it takes longer to do his hair to make him happy. So I would schedule. Learning your clientele is the most important thing as a barber. I can tell who's calling on the phone just by their first name. I did it twice, and I can tell who's walking up the stairs just by their footsteps now.
That was Nelly Gochiva reporting there. And our intrepid associate editor had time for one more pit stop before catching her flight back to London. Canadian designers George Yabou and Glenn Puschelberg have been creating luxurious interiors for over 30 years now, with projects in Canada, Asia, and the US. Their design studio, Yabou Puschelberg, is the mastermind behind the interiors of the W Hotel on Times Square in New York, the Hazelton in Toronto, Lane Crawford in Beijing and Hong Kong, and Bergdorf Goodman in New York too. Nelly caught up with the celebrated duo at their headquarters in Toronto, where they gave her an honest view on the status of Canadian design and shared a thought or two on how aspiring local designers might make it internationally.
But we kind of started naively a year or two out of school. We met in university here in Toronto. We were self-invented in a way, and it was not about making business or creating. Yeah. It was about
there wasn't
creating
a script to follow.
No, there wasn't a script to follow. It was like finding very small, any client we could, because we were passionate about design. And we started very simply and then kind of grew, but it was always this notion of making it beautiful things. And it took us a long time to actually figure out how to make it a manageable and financially stable thing. But that kind of came after, and I always think that if you start from the premise of a passion for something, it has more solidity. And we are now fortunate to work and choose our clients.
What are the main tendencies and changes that you've noticed here
in
on
Canada?
The local market? Yeah, in Canada.
In my opinion, I might be wrong, but I think in the late 70s and early 80s, when we graduated from school and started, I think there was a much greater notion of the possibilities of design locally. I mean, there were some they're gone now, but that were working internationally. And there was a kind of desire for design in the late 70s and 80s. I think that came from the Expo 67s and the Olympics in the 70s in Montreal. And there was a kind of Canadianism in design that was greatly appreciated. Arthur Erickson was a big kind of mentor to us as an architect in Canada and stuff. And there was a Canadianism to the design. And I think that fell away with Canadian insecurity about we should be more international, etc.
I think there's a pride right now in being Canadian more than ever, because Canadians are not patriotic. We're not patriotic like the Americans are. And now we're getting a sense of pride that Canada is feeling like it's gaining respect worldwide. In financial circles, it's been respected for its conservatism and its banking policies, which saved us from the big disaster in the financial world. And so all this is built up of a Canadian identity that's becoming more confident and more proud again. So therefore you see these little, these little startup little studios all over and Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal. They're creating these percolation of little cool, creative little studios and interiors.
That's true.
Can you tell me about your business abroad?
Oh my goodness. Well, I'm working in about 15 countries. Mm-hmm. And we have wonderful projects and clients in many different places of the world, from Opus in Hong Kong to the additions with Ian Schrager in London, the one in Miami. We're developing the flagship Park Hyatt for the Pritzker family in New York, which opens next year across from Carnegie Hall. We're renovating Barney's on Madison Avenue in stages. We're doing a project in Rio on the beach. We're doing a hotel in Cabos. We're renovating Printemps in Paris.
We
have five hotels in India, 10 projects in China, but wonderful projects with Lane Crawford. We just finished a wonderful store, a really gem of a store in the middle of Beijing. It's a 2,000 square meter Lane Crawford store, and to me, it's the most beautiful store we did. It's all based on scrims and light. So it's very ethereal, the store. And we haven't photographed it yet, but I think a very special
in that collection because the store is relatively small compared to the other stores. It's a curated collection, so it's the best of the best, which I love that idea.
It's amazing.
Because it's already pretty good.
For us, we love the adventures of life and traveling and seeing, and we, even China at the beginning was arduous, but now it's so become so sophisticated, so fast, and changes so quickly, and it's so forward that things move quickly and they want the best of the world, which is wonderful. And I think that that's kind of great. I mean, Canada is very conservative, hardworking, and it's very meat and potatoes kind of place, and you know, the embracing of design is somewhat suspect. So we're Canadians are a little bit more careful. And so when you show what you can do and come back, and all of a sudden they look mm-hmm. for it. Because everybody wants beautiful things in life.
I think on the other, if you take the perspective of our clients around the world, they have this comfort level working with us, I think, because we're Canadians. Because we are live half of our life in the main city of Canada, Toronto, which is very multicultural. And I think the fact that we're able to make it work relative to many other places around the world, there is that you probably do understand what we need, whether we're working in Bangkok or whether we're working in Jakarta or Mexico or Milan. So it's interesting, they're more willing to let go and say, show me what you can do for us.
We were talking about, because with our PR companies and stuff, and what makes you unique, and they said, well, you're nice. Well, that was quite funny, and typically Canadian.
How do we make Canadian design renowned internationally? Because people still don't, you know what I mean, when you say Canada, many people would think about design.
Because
people think music, culture mostly, fashion, but not so much design.
There's this insecurity of having to almost appropriate, or like, there's not this self-awareness to say, I believe in myself and I'm going to develop from my own voice.
It's interesting because we only have one, we just finished our only project in Canada, which is a Four Seasons Hotel in Toronto. All our work is international or US based, and they never ask us that question. Like, for a Canadian perspective, because they don't think of us as Canadian. Mm-hmm. But so they don't ask us that. That was interesting. I just thought about it when you asked that question.
I mean, what's interesting, if you look at, I know we're not talking about Avenue Road, but you look at Avenue Road, and we're, you know, working with Stefan on designing furniture there because we believe we can. Why not? There were companies in the 70s that did that in Canada that had designed Canadian furniture and had it made and sold it internationally, and that kind of got lost I think that there is the potential to do that, but you think of it slightly differently. You don't have to manufacture here. You can design here and have it manufactured anywhere you want. And there you can create a kind of Canadian brand. It's interesting. Even in the retail world, these like old companies like the Hudson Bay Company, which was a tired old department store company, and through the willpower of one woman, Bonnie Brooke, she's reinventing it and creating product, Hudson Bay product. We actually introduced Bonnie to Andy Spade
from Spade and Partners
to kind of create Canadian product from an American's point of view, looking at a Canadian. But I think that there is the potential, and there are the individuals that kind of realize there's a vast potential here that's unrealized.
That was Nelly Gocheva with Canadian designers George Yabu and Glenn Pushelberg of Yabu Pushelberg in their Toronto studio. And that brings us to the end of this Canadian Design special edition of Section D. Next week, we'll be splitting the show between Design Miami and the Business of Design Fair in Hong Kong. That'll be cocktails on the beach in Miami, followed by business in the boardrooms in Hong Kong, so be sure to tune in then. Today's show was produced by Gillian DeBias and edited by Holly Fisher. Special thanks this week to our associate editor Nelly Gocheva and her indomitable investigation around the design crowd in Toronto too. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and playing you out, here's another song by Grimes. This is Oblivion. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.